The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Well, we've all heard about the great American fortunes, from the Carnegies to the Rockefellers to the Kennedys. Great fortunes that have been passed on over time, billions and billions of dollars. But it may surprise you that some of the wealthiest families are no longer wealthy. Joining me on the program is the co-author of a new book called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values, Roy Williams, and also from the Williams Group, Amy Castoro. You know, the thing that really surprised me, Amy and Roy, and this led me to getting your book, I was reading an article that talked about the Vanderbilts, where Cornelius Vanderbilt, at one time considered one of the most wealthiest men in the country. By the time it got down to the third generation in the 70s, none of the Vanderbilts were millionaires. That really shocked me.
It's a statistic we see happening pretty regularly. It's unfortunate, but painfully true across the globe.
Now, both of you, Roy, I know you've done this. You've done extensive surveys over 20 years in research of 2,500 family interviews and studying this great wealth. It's amazing. Is there something that really stands out about why this is so? In other words, why almost 70% of the cases end up in failure by the time you get to the second and third generation?
Well, Jim, let me just give you a little quick background. It doesn't surprise you when you understand the history of this event. If you remember the story of the prodigal son, that's over 2,000 years old, and not talking about the forgiveness side of the father, but the unprepared heir who went out and dissipated his wealth is over 2,000 years old. Also, the brother who did not want to accept him back was not prepared. Today, in China, they call it Fubu Goi San Dai. In Italy, they call it from the stall to the stars, down back to the stall. In every country, in every economic entity in the world, and I just learned within the last 90 days that in Bangladesh, they call it great breakfast and no lunch and no dinner. Well, if that's happening, and it's been going on for more than 2,000 years, why is this occurring? That's the question. Because it goes right back to this is an age-old problem. So the next question is, how do we find out why is this occurring? And I talked to one of the major deans. I took summer school classes from him, the dean of the Law School of Berkeley. Again, went to all over the United States and said, what's causing this problem? And without exception, they all told me, and Jim, looking at your history, you'll relate to this, develop a strategy and structure around governance, preservation, and taxes. Those have to be your focus in order to make sure the assets are transferred to the either the trust or heirs or whatever the case may be. Guess what? That is so successful. Something like 98% of the lawyers, and accountants, and advisors actually get the money and the assets where their family wants it to go. Isn't that wonderful? Well, if that's true, why do we have a 70% failure rate after they receive it? Nobody's been addressing that issue.
Amy, when you coach families and things like that, we talked about the 70% failure rate. What are the main underlying causes of failure? Because you're talking in many cases, whether it's the Vanderbilts, of some great, sizable fortunes. Most of these people are smart enough when they made that kind of money. They hire the best tax lawyers, the best tax accountants. So they have the structures. What happens when it gets down to the heirs? Can you explain that to me?
It's pretty consistent across the board for what we see. One of the main reasons is trust and communication, where what's breaking down is an inability for the family members to be able to articulate what it is that they want to have happen in their family. They're not quite skilled on how to have the important conversations that they want to have. Roy, what's the percentage that represents?
Breakdown of trust and communication within the family, that they weighted 60%.
So that's the majority of the reason of why these things break down. The second percentage is 25%, which is that the heirs are not prepared. They're not aware of what's actually going to be transferring to them, and they're not prepared on how to handle it when it lands on their lap.
It's bigger than just to prepare about the assets.
Yeah.
That's one of why I don't want to get us involved in preparing the assets to be managed. Uh-huh. It's being accountable and responsible. And they can be accountable and responsible for being at home for dinner on time and develop trust and reliability on a fundamental, very basic basis. And that's weighted 25% when the heirs are not being held accountable and responsible. And the third factor is purpose or mission. What is the long-term purpose for the wealth? What is wealth? Is wealth stocks, bonds, real estate, business interest? Or does it also include the background, the experience, and the passions and interest of the kids, their spouses, grandchildren, and their spouses? If you can get everybody on the same page talking about what's important as a family, our values, and develop a long-term purpose and a mission using those values, all of a sudden, instead of the wealth being the driver, it's our family that's the driver, and it just blossoms into this magnificent bouquet of a family. Truly magnificent transformation. We see it every day.
Yeah, because, you take a well-known American family like the Kennedys, Joe Kennedy building a substantial fortune, but the subsequent generation all went into public service, whether it was the sons, JFK, Robert, and Ted, and even some of the succeeding generation going into public service. I want to talk about, are any of these failures beyond the family's control? In other words, is there some kind of outside force or a factor that prevents this wealth from being turned into a legacy for multiple generations? Are there any outside factors that have caused that? I mean, I suppose taxes could be one.
Of the 2,500 people, and now since then we've done at least more than 1,000 since then, I would suggest that less than 2% are beyond family control. And even those 2% are the result of choices that they made. We all have bumps in our life. And Jim, I'm sure you've had them just as we've had them. And it's not the bump, it's how we react to the bump. And so when the family comes together and builds the trust and communication, have you ever heard of the word cordial hypocrisy? Well, we had a family where mom required all of the kids to be home for dinner every Sunday. And they were in their 30s and 40s. And they wanted to go to their other in-laws once in a while on Sunday, but they didn't want to hurt mom's feelings. They loved her. And so they kept telling their family, sorry, we've got to be at home. When we finally got to the point where we could have that conversation halfway through the second day of one of the family meetings, mom said, I'd rather go back to cordial hypocrisy. And the kids leaned over in unison as if they were trained to do it and said, Mom, we'll never go back to cordial hypocrisy. And she said, I know that, but she said, it sure was easier on me and everybody here on Sunday afternoon. And so what happens is many powerful men, kids say, with dad money, if he wants to do it, do it, rather than to talk about what's really going on. And for example, here's a great example I saw in the Wall Street Journal, maybe you saw it, Mark Zuckerberg on is going to give away 90% of his estate to charity. What would he do if one of his children was going to be an Albert Schweitzer? Would he throw that baby out with the bathwater? Nobody's asking him those kind of questions because he thinks it's about money. It's not about money. It's about the values. How do we develop those? How do we create centric interests and passions in our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, which I have all of above?
Then why do you think, Roy, that when you have great wealth, as we see in Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, both of them had children. I know Warren, early on in the 70s, passed to each one of his children $300,000 worth of Berkshire Hathaway stock, which is worth a fortune today. They all did something with their life, but the vast majority of the Gates fortune and the Buffett fortune is going to a foundation rather than the family. What do you think is going on there that's different?
Well, first of all, I commend them for that. What a wonderful gift they're giving to society. The issue that I would have with them is how much, and I don't think any because the kids were too young when they started doing it, but at what point in time did they begin to promote the values, include their children in developing a common value, mission, and philosophy? How do we begin to promote the values that we want to promote and let the children fail and make mistakes and not beat them up? In other words, how do we help the children grow and take risks? Those are the things that are missing so many times. You get fathers or mothers who are control freaks. Well, that's a normal parent protection of my babies. Mama bear protects her cubs. That's a normal. When we don't let our children go down the street without their training wheels on their bike or cross the street by themselves alone until we know they're safe, that's a parent, the thing that we all have as parents, and that's to protect our own.
I'm getting the feeling here, Roy, that's really what is needing here by the founder or the patriarch of the wealth is some form of mentoring process of the next generation.
Yeah, but Jim, here's the problem. Now, are you familiar with sign language?
No.
Let me just help you quickly to give you a quick summary. If you take your right index finger up and push it against the side of your nose, that's called boring in sign language. And years ago, I would be in front of my family talking about business, et cetera, and they'd be just blatantly pushing their finger against the side of their nose. And I said, am I that boring? And they said, Pop, you're boring. What I learned is that I could then bring a coach in and say exactly the same thing I was saying, and they'd say, you know, Dad, he's really bright. But what I learned is that parents are role models, good and bad, but we're not coaches. Can you imagine, Jim, trying to teach your wife to drive a car or vice versa? That's not the role of the parents too well. Let's bring in a team of people to help them learn what has to be learned. Jim, you were an investment guy. You have a whole background in investment. If you were going to take the role of money manager and say, okay, Jim, I'd like you to identify the qualification standards, not the legal standards, but the qualification standards you personally would require to replace you as money manager for your family. And when you finish that list of qualification standards, then I want you to go back and say, what are the performance standards that you'd require that individual? Do you know that most money managers can't do what I just asked you to do? They wouldn't know how to begin. Well, how can we begin to train our children if we don't know how? I asked a father to do that who was the president of a company for 40 years. I said, qualification and performance standards for your role as president. 2 weeks later, he called me and said, Roy, do you know how much work you've caused me? I said, what did I do? He asked me those questions. I said, well, how are you doing? He said, based upon my qualification standards, I don't qualify for the job. And based upon my performance standards, I couldn't apply for the job. Well, I said, how much can you imagine your children and your wife being able to do what you couldn't do for 2 weeks? Impossible. So those are the things that are missing, Jim, that we can begin to inculcate into a family and better prepare them to be better stewards. And it's not about money.
What we find, Jim, is that when we can have conversations with the families about values, they find pretty quickly that the values they all share are more similar than they might realize. And one of the things that was missing is how to have a conversation about that that really brings the family together instead of pulling them apart. So while the dad and the mom are role models just by the nature of their role as parents, they may not have the skills to talk about it in a way that the family can hear and will build a future together.
Good point.
You know, Amy, you're a listening coach with the Williams Group. As a listening coach, how do you seek to foster trust and communication within the family unit? I mean, you can take a family that may have 4 or 5 children. How do you get them to agree or create this communication, trust, and purpose if it didn't exist when you first met them?
You know, oftentimes what we'll do is we will just do interviews with each of the individual family members and the trust building begins there. There's a quote, I think it's anonymous, that truly being listened to is an act of love. And many people don't really know how to listen. So in these interviews, people are able to finally speak what they haven't felt like they could say in the past. And they can start to express their desires, their passions, their wants, their concerns, and maybe even start to have the conversations that they've been afraid to have in the past. And so once we get a feel for where everybody's coming from, we start by teaching them how to have these conversations, the tools required so that the conversations build unity. We talk about what is trust, and we talk about how to listen. We talk about our interpretations versus assessments. So we have lots of different tools that we share with them. And once they start to trust themselves and being able to have these conversations in a productive way, it really just kind of pervades the conversation and they start getting more and more comfortable with a new skill set.
Amy, what about the situation where, let's say you are having this conversation with young children who are not adults yet? Won't the knowledge of an inheritance affect their drive and work ethic as they look ahead? I mean, let's say you're talking about a family that has hundreds of millions of dollars, or in some cases, billions, because we have so many billionaires in this country. I mean, you know, if I'm a kid, I'm living a good life, I pretty much have anything I want, and I'm finding out that, you know, someday I may be worth several hundred million. The only reason I'm saying that is I came across early on in my career an heir of one of the great Fortune 500 companies and totally irresponsible, never worked a day in his life, didn't really have a value of money or other people's worth. But, you know, here was an individual that was worth probably $250 million.
That's probably hitting the nail on the head of what keeps a lot of the wealthy parents we work with up at night. They fear that the wealth intended to be a source of good in the world will actually cause harm. And how to navigate that with their children is definitely first and foremost when we come to work with them. What I see that works well is the dad learning how to have the conversations around his expectations. And at the same time, a conversation with the younger kids about fair doesn't always mean equal. So it could be that one child is given more because of their needs and where they want to go with their life. And another one who's sitting on the beach in Maui isn't getting the same kind of benefits. And the dad then sets a conversation that says, here are the standards. Here's how this is going to work. Even before that, there's a conversation around who are we as a family? What's the identity we want to build in the world? And how do we uncover the purpose and drive and passion in each of these kids so that they can see a bigger future for themselves?
A couple of observations there. In most cases, we don't even talk about money for a year or so. Money is, again, irrelevant. That's a way of keeping score. And once the kids understand that the definition of wealth is much, much broader, it isn't just money. Now, one of the problems that they have with parents is that the kids are used to being in private jets wherever they go in the world, and they're used to this lifestyle, and they think that's what money does for them. Once they begin to develop their values and mission and purpose for life, they can begin to look at this and say, gee, things don't determine who I am. And what we find is that kids who get involved with philanthropy, and if you look at philanthropy errors and values, that was about 100 family foundations. What we found is that the kids who got involved with philanthropy, the kids had the attitude that the money and things didn't determine who they were. For example, we had kids each year go with Gus Chalomas on kind of like Doctors Without Borders, and he goes, takes 30 nurses, and he usually takes a couple of teenagers as orderlies. And they operate 16-hour days for 10 straight days. And they take portable operating rooms and everything and out into the jungles. When they come back from those kind of adventures, they find that money and things don't determine who they are, but their values determine who and what they are. And we had one young man come back and went home and he said, I'm really upset. I said, why? He said, do you know that you can go to the grocery store and see more groceries in one room than exists in Guatemala and the entire country? He was dumbfounded at the comparison. And so when he learned that money didn't determine who he was.
Yeah, there were other things more important. You know, this reminds me, and I'll get to this in a second, but I want to get a couple questions in here. Amy, when you're in a room with families, what are the biggest obstacles you normally must overcome? That's one question. And then the other is, if you run into an heir that is made aware of his responsibilities to prepare for a large inheritance, but he's simply not interested in philanthropy or doing anything responsible, how do you deal with, in many cases, what we call emotional immaturity?
Yeah, those are great questions. And we do see them in nearly every situation. The big issues that we see in families are connected to that very concern. It's how is the wealth going to support the family in moving forward? And by that we mean, what are the roles that these kids are going to play as the wealth begins to transition? I can tell you with every interview I do with a mom or dad, that's really what they're concerned about, because they don't want to have a kid sitting on the beach the rest of his life. And so again, what we often come back to there is really trying to create a space that's safe enough for that kid to begin to explore their passion. So if they're going to sit on the beach, we might start to talk to them about, you know, let's talk about the species that are living in the water where the water is becoming uninhabitable. And that might connect to climate change. And then suddenly there's an interest of, well, how about we look at ways that we can start to impact that? And look at that, we can have this kind of impact and you can track how that is having an effect. And we'll teach them how to make those assessments. And so it's really a question of finding out what they are passionate about and creating a space safe enough for them to express it. Another issue we often find is the kids are embarrassed by their wealth. They really don't know how to live with it in a way that makes sense for them. And so a recent family we worked with, there were 7 or 8 kids, and that was even a topic of conversation that they didn't know how to have. And once we had that conversation, they could see they all share the same concern. And then sure enough, they figured out they all share an interest in going to Africa. So off they went, and they could see that their wealth was this incredible opportunity to build a village and bring running water and put kids in school and build the school. And so suddenly the wealth had a completely different meaning for them. And they were very proud of it. Another issue that we tend to find is people in families don't learn how to have difficult conversations. So the son or the daughter that's in line to move into the family business and has been really shaped and groomed for that since they were born, they haven't figured out how to say, boy, that's really not what I want to do. Or another son or daughter that might not be given that opportunity don't know how to say, I'd love an opportunity at that. So really, it comes down to teaching them the tools to have these conversations, not just to solve that particular issue, but so that they can have meaningful conversations for the rest of their lives and a new pattern of communication through the generations. So the fabric of relationship changes because the language changes.
Amy, let me ask you a question. At what point, if you're doing succession planning, what sort of planning is necessary for a successful estate transition? And I guess, when do you start that process? Do you start it early on when the kids are children, or do you wait till they're adults and maybe can understand some of the implications of the enormous wealth? When does that process begin?
That's another great question, and it's one we get often. From our perspective, the sooner you prepare the family for the wealth, the better. And so when a family can work with us or learn the tools to be able to speak about the values and be able to exemplify how to have the conversations that need to happen in a family, so so that there is openness, so that when an interpretation happens, for example, maybe the mom or dad is starting to feel like, boy, my kid is not going in the right direction. They're starting to say, I want to go to a private school, or I want a faster car, or I want fancier clothes. That can sometimes open the conversations. We encourage that the conversations happen much sooner. The place to look for whether or not they're ready to have these conversations are around the dinner table, where they talk about, here's who we are as a family, and here's what we care about, and this is the kind of good we see that our wealth can do in the world. So it's not about the money. It's about the possibilities and the opportunities that can get created. It's about how their legacy gets exemplified and actionable in the world. So it really starts very early, and it's about the investment in the future of the children, but not an investment in the financial, right? It's an investment in how do we want to organize for generations to come? And that's a different kind of investment than what they might be used to. So to answer your question, as soon as possible.
I think what you're implying here, too, this is an ongoing dialogue that begins with young children. So you instill those values in them over time rather than, let's say, wait for a situation where you think, okay, they're mature enough now, let's lay this on them. Because chances are, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, when you have that kind of wealth, the kids are used to, you know, having anything they want. They travel around the world in private jets. They have house servants. I mean, obviously they know they're living a privileged life, unless, you know, the only people they hang around with are people similar to their own situation.
Exactly. And so it's through the conversations of what is wealth. Is it just money, or is it what possibilities or the ways they can impact the world? It's talking about the shared value. It's about what do we want to be, or who do we want to be as a family, and what identity do we want to have in the community? And how do we agree on that? That's really where the leverage is in how wealth transfers successfully. There is an education component about how to empower the children to be wise stewards of the family wealth. That's a different conversation than let's talk about how we're going to just increase how much money we have. And that's a different conversation than how much money each kid is going to get. It's rooted much more deeply in the identity and the legacy and the values that really shaped the wealth in the first place. That's where the leverage is.
Finally, Amy, in your book, you have a checklist for heirs' readiness. The first one, has a family wealth mission been developed with the involvement of the entire family and their spouses? It's kind of like a corporate statement of mission. Many corporations have this. And essentially here, you're doing the same thing. But in this case, you're talking about a wealthy family and the mission of that family and its wealth.
Exactly. And that's really a fundamental piece of the pie here. When we can build enough trust in a family to be able to talk about what do they see the future to be? How do they want their kids to grow up with wealth? What's the way that they want to move towards the future with the wealth so that it's a force of unity and pride in the family? And that mission statement is the roadmap for how they're going to get there. Once we do a mission statement with the family, it's built on these values, and it has aspects to it that are directly lived by the family. So, for example, one mission statement might say, one thing we're committed to a family is education. And so we'll then work with them on saying, okay, if it's education, what does that mean? Does that mean we'll cover 4 years? Does that mean you can go to any university you want for as long as you want? Or is there a GPA required? Or is there a cap on how much? Does that mean they fly first class across the country? So we'll work with them to articulate, how does the rubber meet the road with this actual mission statement? So it's not just an idea. It's something that they live by.
Are there specific observable and measurable standards in place to determine the qualifications for each role? In other words, education, experience, family relationship. I mean, you know, if somebody isn't equated with wealth, finances, the implications of how money's made and maintained, I mean, I think that would be as important as well.
Oh, that's really important, because if the person who assumes the role doesn't really understand what everybody else's expectations are, then it could be that they end up not performing at the level the rest of the family expects. And that can have consequences for everyone, and it can start to breed, again, what we call cordial hypocrisy, where there hasn't been an agreed upon standard or performance expectation. So by the family actually talking about what does it mean to run the family foundation, and if one of the family members wants to step into that, then they as a unit talk about, well, what are our expectations? What do we want to see happen? How will we know if they're being successful? What are the qualifications? How long can they hold that role? And that way we avoid situations where somebody just gets into the position because it's obligatory. So that is an incredibly important aspect of when we talk about roles. What is the role? How does it affect the family? What are the qualifications and standards? Very important. They also use that for learning how to be good stewards. So there might be someone who is responsible for deciding which foundation they want to give money to. And a person in the family might be responsible for figuring out whether or not the family's finances are going to the actual cause, or if it's having an impact, or if that foundation is being run efficiently. So here again, they start to be responsible for their wealth instead of just giving it away like that.
Well, it's a really great, great book. The name of the book is called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values. I was really surprised to hear about your and Roy's book. I didn't realize that there was an organization or a company like yourselves that specialize in basically life coaching wealthy families, a rather unique niche.
Yeah, thank you. It is a really unique niche. And I think one of the things that allows us to do this work in this unique positioning is that we're not actually managing people's money. We're not preparing the assets for the family. We're preparing the family for the assets. And so it's really unique and advantageous to us to work on really just the level of trust and communication family, because it's really not about the money. It's about family unity and skill and having conversations that build trust.
Well, listen, I want to thank both you and Roy for joining us on Lifetime Income. Great, great book. Once again, it's called Preparing Heirs, Five Steps to a Successful Transition of Family Wealth and Values by Roy Williams and Vic Prizer. Thank you so much, Amy and Roy.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.